are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Criminologist Anthony Mioli said Sandra London broke ground in publishing the confessions of serial killer Danny Rowling. But only part of that story could be told in 1996. Now in this unique new volume, the controversy surrounding the making of a serial killer is revealed in a series of interviews and appearances including NBC Dateline, Court TV, Talk Radio, and Courtroom Drama. Mioli shows off Rowling's art with a stunning painting Rowling called his masterpiece and his handwritten explanation of its symbolism. Podcasters Dan Zupansky, True Murder, and Ariel Cooksey, Malice, share thought-provoking conversations that elicit new revelations about London's work with Rowling, and in a sensational secret interview with Rowling is finally revealed. The book that we're featuring this evening is Danny Rowling, Serial Killer, Interviews, with my special guest, journalist and author, Sandra London. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Sandra London.
Oh, Dan, it's always a pleasure to be a guest on your show. You're such a good host, and you ask such great questions.
Oh, thank you so much. You're a great guest, and one of the most thought-provoking programs that we ever have are when you appear. So let's get right to this. You appeared recently on True Murder. We talked about the making of a serial killer. But why this book at this time, and why this approach?
Okay. Well, you know, I set out to do an intensive, in-depth study of Danny Rowling, and I didn't have any strictures upon me, no deadline or nobody to please. So it was a completely untrammeled research project that went on about 6 years directly with Danny Rowling. And my goal there was to learn, because I had been presented with the mystery of the mind of a serial killer years before in the person of Gerard John Schaefer. And when I got through working with Schaefer and published the book Killer Fiction, I still was not done. I still was mystified by this phenomenon. So when Danny Rowling contacted me and offered me the privilege of access to him, I considered it a great privilege. And I was very happy to be able to allow to do this course of study under whatever. I had no idea. No one could imagine the conditions that developed for me doing this story. But I was very committed to doing this. So at any rate, we did the book. Well, it turns out that doing the book is a story in itself. And a book can only be one book length long, and so far as I'm concerned, one subject. So yeah. Out of all that work, The Making of a Serial Killer, it runs about 200 pages, and it's only the material that really relates to that title. And I only covered that much. But in the course of working with Danny Rowling, an enormous amount of material was generated. And I would like to think I was done with that case by doing The Making of a Serial Killer, but it turns out there's some really, really more interesting things that follow on. And so I purpose to do a book I call Beyond The Making of a Serial Killer. And I got about 150 pages into that project when I did my interview with Anthony Mioli. And my goodness, this turned out to be a four-hour marathon interview. And we just stayed on it, and very wide-ranging topics from other cases that he and I had both worked. And we're talking so much about the use of the artwork as being able to convey the essence of the personality. And so those are the things that we talked about. And, well, it turned out to be about 120 pages long. And I said, wow, you know, it's going to take over the whole book. And so I said, you know what, let me just break that out into another book and put some more interviews in it and just do a book only of interviews. So in my mind, I thought I had all these interviews transcribed, and I would just kind of, you know, slap this together in no time at all. It would be like it did itself, you know.
Yeah.
It didn't turn out that way. Transcribing is very hard. I used to be a professional transcriptionist for medical, but not now. I don't want to do any more transcribing stuff. Because and then you use the robot and you get all the uhs and ums, and you know, it's more work to go through there and pick them out than it would be if you just sat and typed it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was my concept. That was why I decided to do this book, and I decided to get this out and then go back to work on Beyond the Making of a Serial Killer, which is really back more to the subject of Danny Rowling's crimes, because in that book I will reveal the confessions to the triple murder in Louisiana. And I'm also including some of Danny Rowling's fiction. He had specialized on a long project called Legends of the Black Marsh, kind of like fairy tales from the Middle Ages with witches and gypsies and princes and princesses and, you know, fiery steeds, you know. And but he did, within that body of work, he started doing contemporary fiction. He still called it Legends of the Black Marsh, but it wasn't. It was contemporary. So I put a couple of those in there because the protagonist in the story is, of course, Danny Rowling.
Right.
So it's another way to see it. So that's what's going to be in Beyond the Making of a Serial Killer when I get it done. Meanwhile, I put out this book of interviews. And to me, it's not like what you'd call a regular true crime book. It's more like a magazine in a way, because you can pick up any part and just read that part. You don't have to read it in order. And in fact, there is no order. It's not in chronological order by any means. If anything, it's the opposite, because I put the interview with Mioli up front. I just feel that it's very conversational, and there's lots of interesting artwork. At the end of when Mioli and I have our little chat, there's a story that Danny Rowling wrote for Mioli, and it's included here, and it's called Rooftop. So he wrote that story after he left my companionship and my collaboration. And I made some observations about how Danny had changed since we last worked together, and it comes out in that story. I included his handwriting because it's become starting to annoy me. People are saying that he didn't write anything, that I wrote it. Okay, and I find myself having to defend myself in the form of putting the handwriting. And I clean up the image from artifacts, so you don't see the wrinkles in that. You just see a black and white image of his what he inscribed against the white page. And there's a lot of information in that. You know, there's a whole body of study about handwriting, graphology, and people who say that your handwriting reveals things about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I consider that as much a part of it as a drawing of a face. Right here, he's using his whole self to inscribe these words. They're not edited. There's no Sandra London in the mix. That's it. So let's just, don't pursue that area of inquiry because it's fruitless. That would defeat my whole purpose in being there. If I wanted to make things up, I would write fiction.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, the thing is, we need to explain, or you need to explain, that not only had Mioli spoken to many other killers before he had a chance to this six-hour face-to-face with Rowling, but did you had also spoke to several serial killers before
Absolutely.
You got a chance to speak to Rowling. So the thing is that when you write that you gave him basically a crash creative writing course so that he was
That's
able
true.
To be able to communicate. And also, as just from the very beginning, he used artwork and symbols, and you can explain,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
the way he expressed himself, so it wasn't like you were directing him to do this, which just
mm-hmm.
happens to be a very entertaining way of presentation, like you say, very much like a magazine, filled with artwork, poems, writing. It's very,
mm-hmm.
very decorative.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why it was essential that he communicate this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did work with a famous author by the name of Joel Norris, who wrote this book, Serial Killers, The Growing Menace, right?
Right.
And people probably don't realize he had a degree in art therapy. Well, I worked with him, and we worked on interviewed Otis Toole, and he was illiterate, okay? So at that point, when I began to work with Toole, I had gone from Schaefer, who had a degree in creative writing and criminal justice, double bachelor's degrees, to Otis Toole, who was functionally illiterate. And I said, well, how am I going to get me anything from him? And it was then that I introduced the very idea that I later called killer art. And I'm just like, well, you can't write, send me pictures. And so then we got to meet him and question him about his pictures in person and do a drawing there. And, you know, watch him do it, worked with him on that. So I learned how you can use that form of expression. And then if you want to, you can go further and delve with the person and say, you know, well, I see that your figure is missing one part of the body. What's missing? And they can't even figure out that they haven't drawn any feet on it. And that has to do with not being grounded. Literally, because our psychology and our body are intimately they're part of the same entity. Okay, so it's like you can't separate your foot from your leg. You can't separate your psychological or spiritual self from your body. So when the body does it, if you want to know about the mind, then you can delve in that direction. When with Danny Rowling, we were participating consensually in revealing the inner workings of his mind. And his, he has often said, I don't understand myself. And when asked if he was dangerous or if he was killed again, he said, you know, I really can't say, you know. He says, my mind has betrayed me, and I really don't know. So, and then look at the appearance he made in court. It's so famous. They play this on TV all the time where he sings mm-hmm. to me, and I'm standing right. there looking really sappy. And he's singing away. But listen to the words. The words are, what were my words? All my tears run together. What were my words? Because at that point, it was understood that, you know, he was half unconscious. And using the arts, the music, gestures, anything nonverbal is closer to the unconscious. You're trying to probe into the unconscious and find out what's hiding in there and who is Gemini, you know. And, you know, in order to get to that level, you can't, the person is not a machine that you walk up and put a quarter in and you get your answers on ice.
That's right.
What you give depends, you have to give, you have to participate to get anything of any lasting significance.
You talk about the use of the third person narrative to be able to explain things and not be able to admit the things, but in this other personality, and Ted Bundy is a famous case, but you also about, you know, you also talked about him, Danny Rowling, being able to do that as well. You say that this is necessary. Why?
Well, there's too much pain involved, isn't there? I mean, for such a dramatic breakdown of one's nature to occur, you have to have enormous amount of trauma and pain behind it. And so going into that is not easy, and it's not fun, and it can really, you know, throw your schedule off for your regularly scheduled activities, because you can break yourself down going back into that place where you were broke down. I remember when I co-authored this book with Diane Fitzpatrick, and she had been under several forms of torture, especially as a child, and we worked all that out. It took 13 years, and at the end, it was a comment that she made to me, you know, now I don't have to go down into the hole anymore. I've been there. I know what it is. It's the hole. So writing, coming to terms with these painful traumas is what I would call the subject there, is a painful experience.
You talk about that Anthony Meoli, like yourself, considered him quite unique in when he asked him questions, again, in this third-person narrative that he would respond. He asked him about the three murders in Louisiana, and he said that his eyes changed, and you commented that that was very similar to your experience. Tell us about what you discussed about this change when they were discussing these murders and this exchange between Meoli and Rowling.
Well, I'm sorry I can't address your question directly. I can talk about a little bit about that, though. You could say, you know what? He's one of those people with those hazel eyes anyway, you know, and it's quite common for people to say those people's eyes change, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that much about brown-eyed people's eyes changing. But he has those kind of in the middle, you know, kind of a pale eyes. So for his eyes to change. Now, remember, Anthony Meoli was there in person with Danny, and I have never been allowed to be there in person with Danny.
Right.
All of our work was in writing, and it's really, as we experienced it at the time, we wanted visitation. The state knew we wanted visitation, so they withheld it to manipulate him to confess. Okay, so being in the middle of it, in the first person, it was, well, we just want to have visitation so we can talk about the things about his life story and his crimes. Well, the state thought they were hurting us by denying that. But guess what? All that did was ensure that everything we did was in writing.
Right.
So there's no question, did it happen or not? There's no question, is this Sandra London saying this? Or is it Danny Rowling saying it? Because every single thing that happened is in writing. So I think it's kind of ironic that in the attempt to defeat our purpose and to make me stop doing my project, they really were part of helping to create it as being a very useful document historically. because it is a document. It isn't just me saying this.
Mm-hmm. This information that Mioli gathered, and he's a respected criminologist, you interviewed him extensively and shared a lot of the things, you shared a lot of the same ideas. It was certainly about the value of the artwork and not so much interpretive, but just in whatever he thought he was communicating.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting that he had an extensive painting collection given to him by Danny Rowling. So both of you have extensive art collections.
Yes.
From Danny Rowling, don't you?
I think it's very interesting. And in fact, Mioli wants to do a book of killer art. He wants me, you know, to co-author it, and I'm not sure what I can contribute. He's the one with all the artwork. He has probably the biggest artwork collection extant today.
Wow.
And I encourage him to do it. I wish he would put out a full color book of his art collection. So
this is impressive, the collection that you put together here, some of the examples of Danny Rowling's art, but also we've got to say that also some of your own sketches of Danny Rowling are quite interesting, and I was impressed with them, so those are also included.
You know, people ask, why are all these prisoners so talented? And my answer is, well, if we locked you up in a cage and took your TV and everything else away and your visits and all your other activities and gave you a piece of paper and a pencil, I'll bet we'd find out you had talent too. You know, I think it's just something that we don't do much these days, take a pen and a paper,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think it's not that exceptional. And I think it looks more exceptional when you look at prisoners, but you have to remember, they're in a cage. They're deprived of a normal life, is the main thing about a prisoner, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about an interview you had with Don Snyder, an interview Don Snyder had with Danny Rowling, and then you got a copy of this after they killed this story. Well, it was from People magazine, I believe, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about this this tape, and really, what did you learn from listening to it?
Mm-hmm. Don Snyder had been preeminent in that whole media empire for years before they even founded People magazine. So he was like a kind of a senior journalist emeritus. Working on special projects at will. And so within that context, and he had contacted me, he came to visit me, and he had some kind of Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer with him, took all these pictures. And but Don Snyder was a very, very thoughtful and in-depth thinker. And he spent enough time with me to find out that I think I'm just not going to say he said this, but I think he found out that what they wanted was not the real story.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he had come to respect me, always sent me Christmas cards and checked up on me from time to time. And so when he went in and got that tape, and so when they killed the story, I took it as a gesture of his own personal goodwill that he gave me that tape. He said, it's yours, do whatever you want with it. Because evidently there was some program going on there, reaching through People magazine, and evidently Don Snyder didn't want to play to that audience.
Right.
So that's how we got the tape. Now, what did I learn from that tape? I was able to really hear Danny change personalities in audio in real time. And that was kind of shocking. first time I heard it, I was like, who's that? And a different voice comes in, you know.
Wow.
And I was like, what? Wait a minute. And turn, when he says, oh, my God, that's him. And he tells this part where he's talking about how Gemini came and whispered in his ear and all. And he uses the voice of Gemini, and it's kind of a whisper. And he whispers the words that Gemini said to him. And then right after that, then he says, in Danny's voice, he says, and I let that thing into me. I let that Gemini spirit into me. And you can tell. You can hear him changing his point of view.
Yeah, wow. Incredible.
Yeah, so that was really important in my in terms of understanding him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to say that dissociation is normal. We all do it. And if I'm if you're there playing with your 2-year-old child and you're talking baby talk, and your boss calls you, you pick up the phone. You don't talk baby talk to your boss. You instantly react in a different mode without thinking, because that's normal, you see. It's normal to have different presentations for different circumstances. What the difference there between normal and Danny Rowling is that his condition was so much more extreme that he had lost control of it. And if you were just normal, you could control and modulate your presentation accordingly. You know, whether you're with the, you know, leading the brownie troop, or whether you're the CEO, you know, of a company deploying 150 people, you could easily do both things. It's not any kind of weird pathology involved. The where we get into the weird pathology is when the break is so strong, it's so extreme, that the different ways of being, they're not merged. They don't flow one to the other. It's rigid. They're separated. You get one or the other.
Your philosophy is throughout this entire book as well. We'll be talking about censorship, of course, and that's raised in this book as well through some of the interviews and some of the things that you were subjected to. And it's very, very interesting that you were able to provide this in this book to show that. That again, the philosophy of the entire truth, I think especially in 96, was something novel, and I still think it is. Maybe you can explain what you mean by that and why you're not an apologist for all the graphic detail and all of the things that Danny Rowling was willing to say about the truth about the murders.
Well, you just laid out about a whole book's worth of dissertation for me to respond to. I don't know. I probably won't cover all that. So let me know what I leave out there. The issue about censorship and telling the whole ugly truth, I will directly connect that to Gerard John Schaefer, because that was his philosophy. And I fought him on this. And I refused to publish things that he sent me. If you want to call it censorship, you could call it that. But and he continually argued his position that it was important for me to recognize that we're dealing with pathology, and if you don't present the pathology, it is a cheat. So I got that from John Schaefer, and it, like I say, that was not my own idea. I had to be convinced of it. And so once he convinced me, then I began to see it that way, because I began to see that entertainment uses mortality as a dramatic device. And we use the idea that someone might die or be killed to build interest in a story and sex it up, to, because we're talking literally about life and death. There's nothing more interesting than life and death. Entertainment requires that you produce a feeling of wanting to buy the sponsor's product at the end of the experience. So they don't really serve their interest to take you on a trip that, you know, a true horror show, leave you unsettled, leave you wondering, you know, if your next-door neighbor might, like what Otis Poole said, just pick up an axe and start hitting you with it. And that's what he said. He said, anybody can go off anytime. You don't know. But to think that way, to leave your audience that way, is not a satisfying aesthetic experience. Now, you know, Shakespeare was a success. He was the rock star of his time. And he never let a play end without leaving the stage littered with corpses. To present that experience to the audience in a way, and then to wrap it up in a way that leaves them intact and maybe with something to think about, but not really disturbed, you know, to the point where they don't want to come to the next play. So I think that those, the demands of entertainment have shaped what we want to hear about. And, for example, I'll use Ann Rule, was probably the definition of successful true crime. And I knew Ann, and we had several talks about this. And the things that I was pursuing, she said, oh, I stay away from that. You know, the JFK assassination, oh, I stay away from that. The Hand of Death cult, oh, no, I don't have anything to do with it. And then she had said publicly things like, who cares if one wino bashes another wino over the head? It's not interesting. Yeah. And that goes all the way back to our theories in aesthetics that we developed from the Greeks and the Romans, that we're concerned with people of significance and what happens with them. We don't care about the bums out there in the alley hitting each other over the head. There's no stakes. There's nothing that we care about involved there. Okay, so I've given a lot of thought to this and how entertainment shapes what our audiences want. And then instead of becoming another Ann Rule and providing exactly what they want, I'm doing the opposite. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I'm more interested in doing things that other people have left undone. Okay? If you want the same old thing, then you can get it easily. And so you don't need me. So since I'm here, why don't I go ahead and do the things that you don't dare to do? I say the things that you don't dare to say, because at least it's not the same old thing. So working with first Schaefer, who really was a terrible experience, and having to be treated to the kind of assaults that he would perpetrate with his writing that he sent to me to publish, it was very painful. But then to come to Danny Rowling, again, he has a different reason for wanting to participate. When I meet this person, he has already committed his crimes. That's a given. You can't get stuck on that level. You can't just keep saying over and over, oh, but he cut her head off. How could you talk to him? That was already done before the very beginning, so it has to be given. So what do you do then? And what he wanted to do was try to give back at least some understanding of what could be learned from the story of his life, from what he had done, what had shaped him, the things that had happened to him. And then he did not shirk in any way personal responsibility for what he had done. So it's the whole picture right there. He wanted to do something good for the world. And I wanted to do something good for the world. Because I wanted to look into this dark corner of secrets. Everyone's too afraid to go in there with the monster. And so you don't find out anything. And he could have lived and died, and none of this, we'd never known any of this. And as far as me, I didn't teach him. And I go back to what Diane Fitzpatrick said about being in the MK Ultra program. She said, now this is after we wrote the book and personal correspondence. She said, it's not like they taught us anything. She said, it's like they enabled us to bring it out in ourselves.
Right.
Okay. So to create a condition to allow the person to come forth in their own way, it's not the same as teaching them how to write. In the case of Danny Rowling, the biggest characteristic he had when I started with him was zero self-esteem. He hated himself so much, and he did not consider himself in any way worth anything. And so when he began sending me these letters, and he would burst into graphics in the middle of the word. He'd just be writing along in words, and all of a sudden it's a picture, you know. And I'm like, what is this? Okay, yeah. I said, Danny, you are an artist. And I said, if you want to draw pictures, please just start a new page, draw a picture, sign it, and date it. Because you are an artist. And anyone who had any contact with Danny Rowling from then on knows very well that how much he took that to heart. Every single page he ever wrote, he dated and initialed. Okay, and then he began, once someone was there to validate him, to see something, to see himself as reflected in the eyes of someone who saw something there, okay? He would look into my eyes, and he would see that I respected him and that he was valuable and interesting. And so from that, he gained enough ego nourishment to come forth with his art, which I did not teach him art. And that's for sure.
Certainly.
Yeah, but I just worked with him until he was a person who had enough self-respect that he would allow that artistic talent to come out and to mature and grow. And Danny, before he died, he had become, I think other people will say, that he had become one of the most preeminent killer artists that of modern times. He's done an incredible body of work. And the thing that I find most compelling about what came out of that was that it is not just decorative. It's not, oh, he's a good artist. It's that he used the graphic arts to probe his own mind. And that's what we're here for. He's not there to make pretty pictures like Elmer Wayne Henley, make the prettiest little landscapes you ever saw, you know. Or Malveaux, and I think Malveaux is a fabulous artist, but he never created anything that delved into his mind.
Yeah,
and so that's why I think Danny Rowling's artwork turned out to be significant.
Yeah, let's use this, Sandra, as an opportunity to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50+ about 6 months ago when it became available for men and teens. And I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual Essential for Women for over 2 years, and she's impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily. She has felt it has made a significant difference in her health. I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources has sold me on Ritual. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, you were talking about the value of publishing and the value of encouraging Danny Rowling and his artwork. But there was a whole group of people that were incensed that you would dare do anything like that and dare have any feelings for this Danny Rowling. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But you include a particularly interesting interview with Dateline, with Jane Pauley. And Jane Pauley has somebody named Jennifer Frake on the program. And then you join a little bit later. As it is demonstrated in this interview, or illustrated, what exactly happens? What is the premise of it? Tell us a little bit more about your invite onto this with Jane Pauley on Dateline and Jennifer Frake's appearance. Tell us more about what happens.
Ha ha ha. I'm happy to talk about NBC. Boy, they started when I was down at the trial, at the murder trial, and they sent a producer down from New York specifically to camp out on me and get me to agree to an interview. And I told them no. Okay. I haven't gone into this part yet in print, but I'll just go into it with you now. I was under contract to Maury Terry, who's been in the news again recently.
Right.
And Maury Terry had me under contract and told me that he was going to arrange exclusive coverage and for me to tell everyone no. And so that's what happened. I told everyone no. And the other part of it, what Maury Terry was going to do for me and manifest for me, that didn't work out quite that way. But let's go back to NBC. So NBC's down there, and they're, the motel I stayed in for the trial, I had talked to them about my privacy and instructed them not for no one there to admit I was there or where I was, and they breached that. They leaked that out to the press. So every time I had to step out of my door, they would be camping out there. So NBC sent them one down, and it was kind of funny. I told her, sure. I said, so we can talk. You can take me out to dinner at the Outback. That'll be great. And then she's like, oh, I'm vegan and everything. I said, that's cool. You don't have to eat it, you know. And, oh, I'm a marathon runner. I said, that's wonderful. Okay, we're going to the Outback, right? And you know, that's it. That's my commitment to you. I'll let you take me to the Outback. So then she comes to pick me up. Oh, why don't we go to Steak and Shake instead? I'm like, goodbye. And so that went on, and then that did not succeed. And they sent a third producer down from New York to bird dog me. Okay. This one got sent to Maury Terry. So they were negotiating back and forth. Maury Terry was saying, we don't pay for news. I said, well, you pay for entertainment. You want to do an entertainment story? And then you pay for it, you know. And they were like, oh, no, it's not entertainment, it's news. So that didn't go anywhere. Okay, so those were the three producers that came down to Gainesville to bother me in person.
Right.
After that, they switched to calling me at work and insisting, demanding, and then they're like, well, we're going to do this story anyway, whether you participate or not.
Oh, great.
Okay. And so I did agree to do this story. Now, this was a transcript of the first appearance I did on NBC Dateline, and I just couldn't believe they had the nerve to call me again and want me to go on again. And in fact, I did go on again, but I had some secret weapons. My good friend and alumnus had been very high up in the DA's office in New York State and organized crime, and he trained prosecutors for the state. He came down from Albany to my hotel in New York City and put me through coaching session par excellence. And then he would throw me questions, and then I would answer, and he said, no, you can't be angry. You can't be angry. Now I would do it again. And so I had that training session with him because he was my friend. And so I did the second appearance, you know, and it was just as damaging. I had over 250 death threats. When I tried to report it to law enforcement, they said that they didn't accept that kind of report. Okay.
Oh, really?
And I stopped counting after the 250th threat that I was keeping track of. But all this was deliberately done, and as I told them when they were trying to argue me into appearing all day, I would say, look, I'm not that big of a story. What's the big deal? You know, why are you so determined to get me, you know? And now I realize that they were getting their marching orders from intelligence, frankly, because I've learned more since then, you know, from other people and other sources. But now I realize that's what that was. Okay, so... So here we have what happened in this story there that's in the book. Janet Frake. All right. The Making of a Serial Killer includes one chapter where Danny wrote about committing a rape in Sarasota. Danny Rowling did not know the woman's name and did not name her or identify her in any way. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so... then they come forth with this bogus story that she was in her local Barnes and Noble browsing the books, which people who knew her in Sarasota said was absolutely preposterous, knowing her reputation and her other activities. But she was browsing the books in Barnes & Noble when she found this book, and she opened it up, and she saw where he was writing about her, and she fell to her knees there in the aisle. Okay. She literally fell to her knees. Oh, she was so devastated at this write-up. And then the other handle on this story was the hero cop. Now, the hero cop, allegedly, according to the story presented, heard about his rape, not from reading the book or anything, you know. Couldn't say that, so he just knew about it, I guess. And so he ran her DNA against Danny Rowling and got a hit. Now, why is this nonsense? Because the statute of limitations on rape had run, okay? That means that there was no active case open, okay?
Right.
And that means that any law enforcement agency in the state of Florida that expects to get the services of the state lab has to fill out a form with the case number on it, okay, to even file it, okay? The next thing is, during that same time frame, I had a murder suspect, and we got his DNA, and it took the state lab 18 months to get around to it, even though it had a case number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the state of the art of the state crime labs. They're underfunded. They're way behind. You don't just run down there and check the DNA. He said, quote unquote, he checked it on Rowling on a hunch. Oh, a hunch? What hunch? And what about your boss? How did he approve of you spending your time that way on a case of rape that had been, you know, committed over 7 years earlier? None of that holds up. That just doesn't hold up. It didn't happen.
But, Sandra, that's what Jane Pauley was, you know, I mean, the way the interview went and the way it was produced,
mm-hmm.
obviously they interview you and then they put
mm-hmm.
voiceovers and
yeah,
and
yeah.
it's very, very dramatic and obviously
mm-hmm.
one-sided to say the least in that
oh, yeah.
they just empathize with Frake, Janet Frake. But
yeah.
the thing is that you talked about that this is all entertainment and but at the same time you have to admit that you made a conscious decision to not be a writer like Anne Rule and
mm-hmm.
saw the future
mm-hmm.
and were more was more interested in the way
the whole
you would
story.
Present a book differently than Anne Rule. Not
mm-hmm.
everybody wrote like Anne Rule even at the time, but to be successful. So the thing is, I got to say that you also use controversy, and not to say you deserve the ridicule and the humiliation and the attacks and the trying to end your career economically, but I'm saying that it seems that Jane Pauley is poking you with the idea that you don't have enough empathy, and how
mm-hmm.
dare you have
mm-hmm.
feelings for a serial killer?
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
the way they're painting this. And so, why do you present this in the book? And again, people see this as you somewhat attacking or criticizing Janet
mm-hmm.
Frake.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not that?
Why is it not that? I don't know what that means. What do you mean? Why is what not what?
Well, the thing is with Janet, like I say, that you talk about her family taking a movie deal. You talk about this in the book.
That's the murder victim's family. That's not...
Okay.
Now, Janet Frakes did file suit against Danny
mm-hmm.
Rowling
That's
for $1 million.
Right.
That was not the state lien.
Right. And this lawsuit, you write, though, too, is that she, because of the statute, and there was no way that she would have collected any of the money. So you say
no.
this is disingenuous, some of the stance that she takes, because... It's just not, she's
uh-huh.
not going to get any money from this, and she's not going to get any recourse
from
this.
Well, here's the ultimate irony. I nor Danny Rowling revealed to the world her name and her face. Jane Pauley did that.
Right.
Okay, so if that's such a heinous offense, that the story of what happened to her should be known, if that's so offensive, then what's Jane Pauley doing?
Yeah. That's right. Well, like I said, I think it's fair.
No one
would
have ever known that the person in the story was her. There was no way. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter. Jane Pauley went and dug it up and put her on TV and striking all these moral poses. And I'll tell you what, a little dialogue that was off the record on that deal. And when we got through taping and everything and we were standing around and everything, I said, Jane, you know, you can strike poses at my expense all you want. I said, but you can't keep from saying my name. And
right.
She laughed. She said, you're right. You know, because that's the ultimate irony. And this is what I brought out in the controversy with the state governor of Wyoming who wanted me banned from AOL. And I went on Larry King Live to say I want to thank the governor for catapulting me into the spotlight. I was working in obscurity until he chose to bring me to the attention of millions of people all over the world. CNN was on 200-something countries, you know.
Yeah.
And I say, all of a sudden, my website is flooded with, you know, people wanting to, and I have all these offers to do interviews. And I said, I just want to thank the governor, you know, for bringing me to the attention of all these new audience. And that was the same thing I would say to Jane Pauley. Well, I said it in a different way. You know? And
it's interesting.
She also said, our attorneys have believed that you are in the right on the state lawsuit. And I said, oh, so will they file an amicus brief? Oh, no, she said, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. This Son of Sam legislation, too, you talk about this thing already being struck down, and then yet at the same time, this has already been deemed unconstitutional, and then you are still being, tried in the media over this as well. So,
I was being tried in court. Took all of my money, and they went further than that. It wasn't
and what was
just
the premise?
In
I know
the media.
And what was the premise, though? Because the idea that the perpetrator is not to profit from the notoriety of his crimes. What's that got to do with you? How could they get around that?
Here's what they did. They attached me to the felon under a legal principle that they invented, and they called it unique and special. Okay, just savor the sound of that for a minute if you know anything about law. Unique and special means unprecedented, either in law or in custom. No one has ever, and he said that himself, when he was given, the Attorney General was given a Lifetime Achievement Award for what he did to me, okay?
Yeah.
And when the Associated Press covered that, he admitted, but he didn't say it as if he should be ashamed of it. He said it as if it was evidence of what a brilliant attorney he was. He said, I haven't heard of anyone this law has been used against who was not a felon. Okay?
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
that was his, he was so creative. I don't know of any other case when one of these type of cases was brought against a non-convicted person. Okay, and he told the Associated Press he always wanted to be successful, but he never suspected that his success would be measured by how well he prevented someone else's.
Right.
So they had no real legal precedent and no way to attach me to this action. In addition, there was no money. Okay, no money was ever paid to Danny Rowling, and that's easily proven because his accounts are public record.
Right.
Okay, there was never any money. The lawsuit was brought under prior restraint, which, again, is improper, illegal, I was sued before these stories were written. They were not written.
Extraordinary. Yeah.
Okay. When I was sued. So there's, you know, I could go on and on about how bogus this action was, but I will bow to the wisdom of Steve Dunleavy, the anchor on A Current Affair, that I brought this to, because I was already doing stories for him, and he said, nobody gives a bleep about the First Amendment. It's not a story. And, you know, I don't want to hear that either. But I'm afraid that that's the way it is. The eyes glaze over. It's as if our constitutional protections against abuse, as if that's just nothing. That's just a bore. That's a big bore. Okay, and if there was an injustice done to you as a journalist, who cares? Have you got another story?
Yeah.
You know. It's not a story. So the fact that, I don't really want to leave the stage without putting it on the record, the things that I had to go through because I did the story. And this book here, Danny Rowling's Serial Killer Interviews, does put those things on the record, or some of them. And it gives you an idea that that this was a historically significant event. Bringing this book into being, being the making of a serial killer, to the effect that all these spinoffs were generated in terms of the impact. So
yeah, he like we mentioned that he said that this was groundbreaking in the publishing the confessions of a serial killer, Danny Rowling, especially in 1996. Let's use this as an opportunity to just stop for a second for these messages. Now, we talked about this groundbreaking journalism that you were doing and other people weren't understanding. And getting back to these interviews that are involved in here, no, we had an interview October 20th, 2020, about the making of a serial killer. But you also had an interesting interview with Ariel Cooksey from the Malice podcast.
Yeah.
And a lot of things I found very, very interesting, some of the things that were revealed and you discussed and came out of that interview. So tell us a little bit about that interview and what was had from it.
Whoosh. I don't really have a response to that. If you want to ask me about, you know, something we talked about there that I could expand on, I mean... doing an interview, I'm just there, and it starts and it goes, and then it ends.
Yeah, well, you talk about that when she asks about Danny Rowling, and you talk about this this hatred was not just so specific to the victims, but society more at large. So you talked about maybe the impetus for all of this was the abuse that he suffered at the hands of his father and that disappointment and rejection and lack of love. How did that, you discussed that. So tell us what you discussed about that, that abuse.
Well, I can say this, that I think that if it was just his father, he would have been a simple patricide. And if the a contretemps between him and his father had come to court, he would have been... exonerated under self-defense because his father shot at him six times before he fired back. And so, but the drama with the father playing the central role, if he was simply a patricide, then there would not be a story. But what happened there was that society played a role, and society refused to protect the child, okay, and society indemnified the father. because he was a good officer and those things could go on. And I would say that if there was a turning point where this child could have been saved, that was it. When society allowed the abuse and indemnified it. And from that point on, eventually it coalesced in his mind that his enemy was not his father, it was society.
Right.
So, under the terms that he presents as the drama that went on within his mind, it was a deal expressed in terms of one life for every year that you were tortured in prison. So that is an abstraction. That's not a love rivalry or trying to sell body parts or any of the things that we have for these multiple homicides. It was an abstraction. It really had nothing to do with who these victims were. It wasn't. You know, when you get out of prison, you're going to hunt, like with Schaefer. Oh, he threatened the defense attorney. He threatened the prosecutor. He threatened the judge. You know, he threatened the sheriff. He was going to get out. He was going to have his organized crime people go after them. Well, that's not what this was. This was against what someone with a heavily Christian background might refer to as powers and principalities.
Yeah. What we talked about, what we alluded to just there, was that his aunt, I believe, went to police and reported the abuse
aunt
from the
Agnes.
Father.
Mm-hmm.
And the police said, "Nah, but he's a good cop, and so we're not going to interfere into anything
That's
domestic
right.
like that." And you say this is good enough impetus for sure. You also
but
talked
the,
about
the
this.
The point is that it was a turning point that that in his mind that made him a serial killer. It wasn't because he wanted to stalk this victim and find them and target them and learn about them and tease them or like a BTK send things to the paper about them. Nothing. He was working out a revenge type concept against society. So who did he choose? Well, he didn't say he didn't choose. He'd say Gemini that chose. But okay, why did Gemini choose that victimology? And my answer would be because these were young people who belonged and were cherished by society. Their parents put them in school and took care of them. They were well-kept. They were valued. And I see if there was only one image of Danny Rowling, it would be a guy with his nose pressed up against the window of life, watching life go by and knowing he could never be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about this revenge on society as well. Anthony Meoli does a very interesting statistic, and you remarked it is very interesting, about this 1-2% of serial killers in his experience are people that would pose a body like Danny Rowling did.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, there's an extra emphasis on anything you do at a homicide beyond just ending the life of the victim. If you have ended the life of the victim, the hitman's point of view or the businessman's point of view is get the heck out of Dodge and live to kill again another day for whatever reason. If you do any, if you stay there at the scene of a crime for any reason, it has to be given great weight because what were you doing?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That was more important than getting away with murder. Why were you still there? Well, there was more to do. And the way he would express it, he would go into spiritual terminology and to say that he had to exemplify evil, pure evil, and that he had to destroy the works of God. The human figure was the works of God, the beauty of the works of God, that he had to destroy that because why? And that took a while because he kept saying, well, I don't know why. And he kept saying, I don't have a message. And I said, well, everyone says you do. And so, and he said, if there's any message, it's Gemini's message. I said, well, you ask Gemini. You know him. I don't. And so eventually it just came through from that type of dialogue saying that evil walks this world like a natural man, and that he was there to show that evil is real. So that's as far as we're going to get with that, my friend. There's no other source. There's no other source on that. That's as far as it goes.
You talk about that while his case was ongoing and while his life was in jeopardy.
Yeah.
He cared very much about this book, and he cared very much about your agreement. We haven't mentioned that, is that you were very experienced with other people, and what was unique was your agreement with Danny Rowling. What was unique about what he did concerning your agreement?
Mm-hmm. Well, what was unique is that Danny, you would think that someone would be thinking about their case. And he never expressed any interest in it, and things would appear in the news, and I would think that I would want to know his reaction. He didn't even know he would get the legal work in the mail and not even open it. And he, when it came time for him to plead, decide what to plead, he wrote to me. And he said, there are several things I need to consider and when I plead. And the first, number one, how is this going to affect our story? And then there were two other things. The last one was the victim's families. And then he went into his discussion of his bullet points, and he talked totally about how is this going to affect our story. He never got to the part about the victim's family item that he listed. And I called his lawyers when I got this letter, and I said, you better go down there and get a hold of him. I said, he is more concerned about this story than he is about his own life. And his lawyer said to me, that's how it's always been with Danny.
Yeah. Okay. You do an interview on with Ron and Ron, and what I found interesting is, again, I mention it again, is that you include information and material in this book that many people would not include. They would take out anything where, like a negative review, people would, if they had their way, they would take all of those and never ever get to see them. But you've included this. And one of the biggest exchanges on this radio show is that callers call in and talk about your culpability and that you should fry along with Danny Rowling. And that they can't understand your viewpoint on the death penalty. So you do talk about that viewpoint. Tell us how you feel and what people might say in contrast to what you're saying about the death penalty.
About the death penalty, I say that if you have a feeling in your heart and you cultivate it that you want someone to be killed, then you are exactly the same as a murderer, because murder, under the law, doesn't exist unless you have mens rea, or the guilty mind. So you could literally kill someone, but if you didn't have that evil intention in your heart, it wouldn't be murder. Okay, that's what makes it murder, is that intention in your heart. So if this is the intention that you're expressing, it's ironic, because you're blaming someone else for being homicidal while you are expressing the desire for a living person to be killed. And I wish that that irony were made more prominent, if it were possible.
And you say, too, that this is evidenced by people literally jumping up and down with glee and rejoicing. This is not a somber, you know, closure thing. This is exactly what you describe.
Well, that's why I wrote the song, and they played the song on the radio, And I wrote the song after going through the murder trial there with Rowling. And it was so traumatic, I remember that I lost my voice. And I only got my voice back while I was driving back home from Gainesville and making up the song. I got my voice back by singing this song I was writing about death row. And the verse about the those who are dancing, I'll just tell you, it says, the undead memories of the lives you've taken, they won't let you rest. Every night you awaken, they're dancing on your grave, demanding nothing less than your whole life. Because you've been dancing with the Reaper. Now every day you see him in your own eyes. So this goes on, and then at the end I speak, and this is what I would like to say. If I only had a few words, my last words would be, execution makes us killers too. I know, I'm a killer, and so are you. Vengeance demands the killer die. When will we stop and wonder why? God help us all.
Yes, it's a very, very fascinating collection you've put together, Danny Rowling, Serial Killer Interviews. I want to thank you very much for this, again, fascinating interview. For those that might want to take a look at other work or find this out, can you tell us about the Amazon page, website, etc.?
Well, my books are on Amazon, but I'd like people to know that I have a website called SandraLondon.com. And if you go there, there are excerpts from all the books, and then links appear there to the Amazon page where you can buy it. But you can get previews and reviews, as Dan mentioned, the bitter with the sweet, you know. That's what controversy means.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an impressive collection, and I think it'll be a collector's item, to tell you the truth. I really do. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this latest Danny Rowling serial killer, and we look forward to speaking to you again when finally you talk about beyond the making of a serial killer.
Thank you
so much, Sandra London. You have a great evening. And hope to talk
to you
again soon.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm always happy to appear on your show.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. You have a great evening.
Bye.
Good night.